Wow, yes, it is on. As you can see, this is a low-budget event. We are sharing one microphone. But then again, your fees were low, so no complaining.
You should plug in your projector.
No, you should turn off the projector because I don't have any slides. This is so that I can monitor Intel stock prices the market opens. My name is Dirk Hondel. I'm the chief Linux and open source technologist at Intel. And it's a great pleasure to be here. I actually am a German and am enjoying the fact that I'm here again for a change. I live in the US. I have done that for the last 6 years. And it's always fun to come home. I'm kind of disappointed about this change with the smoking, because all Germans love to complain. It's the national pastime. And so I always love to be able to arrive and say, oh, it sucks, it stinks here. And I was so thrilled when I arrived in Frankfurt, and there were literally 30 people around a trash can under the no smoking sign. Ah, it's Germany as I know it. Anyway, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Following Karl-Heinz Strassmayer and Howard Chu as keynoter is an honor, I guess. Actually, it is an honor. I was here last year for Howard and his violin play, and I was thinking, what can I do that can top the violin play? And I stopped thinking there. That's not going to happen. So why am I here? I guess the simple answer is because someone was foolish enough to ask me. But actually, I do have a little bit of background in open source. I've been doing this open source thing for a little over 20 years. I've been doing Linux about as long as Linux exists. I used to run x386 for a while, and I'm responsible for most of the brilliant code that Keith Packard is now happily ripping out. And oddly enough, he does that while working for me. I used to be the CTO of SUSE, which might mean something to the Germans in the room. And for the last 6 years I've been with Intel, and I've tried to get Intel to understand what this open source thing is all about. And I'm quite proud to say that 6 years ago, most people, when you ask them about Intel and open source, would say, ah, Intel, Wintel, who cares? And that today, I think we are quite respected as being a very open source, savvy and open source friendly company. And that to me is a very important achievement. Today, I'm not so much a coder anymore. I do have 4 kernel patches in the last 12 months, yes. I think the open source project I'm most active in is, embarrassingly enough, WordPress, which is a blogging tool written in PHP. That just shows you how little I really do. But nonetheless, what I do for a living, actually, is talking to people. So while, wow. On the seventh day, he said, let there be light. No, that was earlier in the week. Anyway, where was I? There is a very interesting statistic that if you ask the average American, what are they most afraid of? To die today, to, be kissed by a partner of the same sex, to give a public presentation. The majority of Americans is more afraid of a public presentation than dying today. And I love giving presentations, so I have the ideal job, because that's what I do. I talk to people. Talking to people is very interesting. Who in this room would identify him or herself as a developer? Who would identify him or herself as a business person? Oh, a few of both. Business people and developers speak different languages. They might use the same words. They might speak towards each other. But usually, communication does not happen. And what I like about my job is that my job is to translate between those two groups. So I get to explain in simple MBA terms to the business people what open source is all about. And I get to explain in simple geek terms to the developers that the business people are not totally crazy, even though all evidence is otherwise. And that is truly a great job. So what is open source? Well, we're at Samba XP. I'm not going to explain to you what open source is. Samba, Apache, Linux, MySQL, we've all heard it. But I hear the first laughter down there. Actually, I think open source is a little more than that. I mean, think internet infrastructure. Think sendmail and all the sane implementations of MTA. Think bind. Think the fundamental infrastructure that the internet runs on, the stuff that Al Gore invented. We do have a few Americans in the room. Good. And he's not running for president this year.
Yes.
No applause. Good. Actually, I would use open source even more aggressively. I would talk about things like, say, TCP/IP. I would talk about things like, you know, the X protocol. Really useful stuff that is so universal today because it came from the beginning with an open source implementation, long before Bruce Perens and his merry band of happy people invented the term open source and the open source definition. And I'd go even further than that, and I would say it's open standards. Open source extends all the way to open standards and to our ability to interoperate, to our ability to have a working internet, to be able to have me with my Mac here actually connect to the same network that all you Linux geeks and, are there Windows people in the room? Oh, never mind. For all of you to connect to the network and for all this to interoperate and work with each other. Now, right now talking about open standards is a very dangerous topic. Because standards are a little bit under siege, and there is a fascinating battle going on regarding the standards for document formats. And since I work for Intel, and Intel has, I think, about as many lawyers as engineers, no, I don't think that's true, but a lot of lawyers, I can't comment on that. So that's a different talk. What I want to talk about today is not a very Samba-specific topic at first, but I think it's quite relevant for the community. I want to talk about the relationship between open source projects and developers and corporations. And that's a relationship that seems very simple at first. You know, corporations are good. They give us money. But it's actually a little more complicated. And a lot of projects run into very unpleasant situations because they don't think this relationship through. So that's the topic, open source and the role of corporations. So who writes open source projects? How many are there? Who knows? How many open source projects? You should know. You work for Red Hat. So you have to know how many open source projects are there.
Many.
He's a very specific person. Anybody even more specific than that?
17,264.
Very specific and very wrong, okay. So there, if you just go to the two biggest aggregator sites, Google Projects and SourceForge, there are currently more than 120,000 open source projects. And amazingly enough, about 80% of these projects have between 1 and 3 developers and between 1 and 3 users. here's my favorite thing to do. Go to a SourceForge, use the search feature, you know, type in random letters. And you know, you always get the kind of the fuzzy answers. And then look at a random open source project in SourceForge and you don't look at the last time code change was contributed or look if there's documentation. It's hilarious. A lot of people go through the trouble of starting this project. And then usually they run out of energy. It's kind of... But if I ignore the 80% of the projects that are stale or kind of irrelevant or so narrow that no one is using them, and that are done by hobbyists only, if I look at, you know, like the top 5% of the project, which still is, you know, 5,000-6,000 projects, there is a very odd difference to that bottom 80%. And that odd difference is that in the top 5%, roughly 80% of the code comes from people that are paid to write this code. So this perception that open source is written by hackers for hackers, you know, it's the underground, it's the, you know, the people with the, I don't know if I can say this in this room, it's the people with the ponytails and, you know, the bad personal hygiene. No one personally, please be offended. But having spent a lot of time with development, never mind. So there actually are people who take the time to study this. One of my favorite studies is the one that John Corbett of LWN and Greg Kronhartman, Greg K.H. of Novell have been doing for about a couple of years, where they track the contributors to the Linux kernel. And they went through a lot of trouble to try to basically match the email addresses from people who submit patches to the companies that they work for. Because a lot of people, for a variety of reasons, do not use their corporate email addresses when submitting patches. And they have exactly the same number. 80% are paid by corporations. And that includes Linus, who has this brilliant job at the Linux Foundation, where he basically is paid handsomely for being himself. I want that job. But the same number holds roughly true for most of the big projects. And doing a little bit of searching around Samba makes me believe that the same is true for Samba. Because most of the people who call themselves, you know, the Samba team, have someone pay their bills. Whether it's someone who has direct interest in the project or someone who claims to do no evil and you know, just... No, you don't, actually, but that's okay. So corporations are very involved, and corporations are very critical to what we consider open source. There was this great study released yesterday by an analyst research company that I've never heard of before, so very trustworthy, that stated that open source is stealing, their word, not mine, $60 billion. So in real money, that's like 38 billion euros. From commercial software companies. So why would a company support the, again, they were stealing of $60 billion? So let's try this. Let's try this one more time. Who are the companies who do that? I mean, who are the obscure little companies that pay people to do open source? Must be startups or, you know, nonprofits. So the top three contributors to open source software are, any guesses? Don't you wish? Not even close. For the kernel, yes. For the kernel, Red Hat is the top contributor, correct. But overall, open source, not even close. So who are the top three?
IBM.
That's number two, yes. Well, depending on whose metric you use. Let's just say they're in the top three. Metrics are a fun thing. Only, as I have a master's degree in math. So only try the trust statistics that you falsified yourself. It's it's an old mathematician's rule. Okay, IBM, that was a good one. Who else?
Microsoft?
I'll get back to you on that one. Intel, very good guess, yes. And? Not even close. Sun.
What?
Sun is by their own metric the number one contributor to open source. By other people's metrics, still in the top three. There is an open source version of Java. There is OpenOffice. There are lots of things that Sun does. They bought this, what's the name, MySQL company for what?
They're fixing that. Pardon me? They're fixing that according to Slashdot.
Yeah, well. Anyway, so obviously it's very big companies. Google is a huge supporter. Google has hired Jeremy. They've hired Andrew Morton. They've hired lots of very smart people. And contrary to initial belief, some of them actually get to contribute code, which is good. Google is getting a bad reputation lately. Man, you need to work on that, really. I mean. Maybe you should wear a Google t-shirt or say Google is cool or something like that. We're not as evil as we look. By the way, this isn't being recorded, right? Okay. Good. Did I mention I work for Intel? I do not speak for them. They don't pay me enough for that. What was I trying to say? Oh yeah, I was trying to say it's big companies. It's big companies who, in general, are not suspected of acting as, you know, charitable organizations. Companies, with very few exceptions, are bound by the bylaws to be in the business of creating value for their shareholders. As an Intel employee, I'm very proud to say, yes, we are. We just released earnings, and within 10 days after an earnings release, I would actually be allowed to talk about our financials, but I won't. Other companies have a little bit harder time making money, but nonetheless, companies in general are not charitable organizations. So why do they do open source? Anybody has a guess? Why do? Why?
And adds value to products that they can't make money on.
Ah, there's a smart person in the front. It works and it adds value to the products of that company. Let's talk about Intel for a second, because I happen to know a bit about the company. We sell these little, you know, potato chips, no, microchips. Don't eat them, they taste horrible. And in general, I work in the software and solutions group in the Open Source Technology Center inside Intel. And as the software people inside Intel, and we have a lot of them, we have, you know, Intel has something like 10,000 software engineers, which most people don't realize. We are, if you just look at our software group, we're like the fifth largest proprietary software vendor. No, not the fifth largest employer of software engineers. That's the word. And we software people tend to say Intel's chips are fantastic at heating space, unless you have software to run on them. So software is a good thing. And so from our point of view, having more software, more solutions available to potential customers is good. And having competition is good. Well, competition in software is good. Actually, competition is good everywhere. The days when there is little competition in the chip business tend to be bad days for Intel, even though Intel often isn't aware of that. I have only been at the company for 6 years, I can still say that. So where am I going with this? I'm going to the point where I'm saying companies get into open source because they want benefit. For IBM, I'm not speaking for them, I'm just making a hypothesis here. For IBM, I think it's complementing their proprietary software offerings. It's similar to us creating a software ecosystem on top of the hardware. For Sun, I have no idea, but I'm sure they have their reasons. So when you work with these companies, you need to really understand why they're doing this. Because the reasons why people do things really impact their actions and impact what their actions mean to you. So be aware, oh no, beware of Greeks or geeks bearing gifts. Someone comes to you with code or with promises of code or promises of, as in company speak, resources or headcount. Be very careful. There might be strings attached. There might be little pitfalls that you don't like. Make sure you understand, why are they doing this? Help in general is good. Getting people to work on any open source project is appreciated. And as I know, Samba is a project that has many, many people who are thrilled to, you know, test code, write good documentation, maintain the website, you know. This is what all the geeks will do. Who besides John is working on Samba documentation? Thank you. It is actually one of the saddest things about open source, how pathetic and bad the documentation is. As a very active user of open source, I am always shocked that, I mean, so what do we all use for manual today?
The source.
Well, no, you use the source for manual. What does everyone else use for the manual? Exactly, thank you very much. Here, they are the good guys after all. Literally, whenever, I mean, I set up OpenVPN, I get a stupid error message, you know, cut, paste into Google with quotes, and you get 20 articles discussing that error message. I love it. But that's not documentation. Let's not go there. I work for a company who has great relationship with our partners that are commercial software vendors, and my employer would look badly on me bad-mouthing those people.
But you don't speak for them.
You think they care? Still, it has never stopped me from doing it, but at least I should pretend. So in the commercial software world, there is the assumption that there is good documentation. The reality more or less depends on the price tag. If you look at more expensive software, I mean, if you buy SAP, it comes with about 185,000 pages of documentation. You read them, you understand the stuff. It's really easy. So no, to me, what is so sad about the fact that our documentation is so bad is that there are so many people excited about open source. But everyone wants to write code. When did being a geek become so hip? It's amazing. But I wish more people would actually, you know, well, more people with the right skill set would start writing documentation. And that is, for example, a place where it's very good if a company says, oh, I want to contribute to your project, say, hey, great, or hire a tech writer who can write good documentation for us. And that's really, really useful. But usually companies are just like any other geek. They want to write code. They want to contribute code. And they usually want to write code that helps them. And again, the easiest company to talk about is Intel. So why do we contribute to projects? Well, usually we try to figure out what our customers are trying to do with the project and how we can make that happen better on our hardware. So for example, as some of you might have noticed, the gigahertz race is kind of not happening anymore. The frequencies don't double in every 18 months anymore. Instead, the number of cores goes up. And with our next generation processor that we'll introduce sometime later this year, I guess, we'll bring back something that you will fondly remember as hyperthreading. And not only the number of cores goes up, even the number of threads goes up. Still, most software today is embarrassingly single-threaded. So a lot of the work that we do when we engage with open source project is helping them to, you know, work better in a multi-threaded environment. And since some open source projects have their roots in the days of CPM and DOS 2.1, OpenOffice would be a great example for that. The threading engine and threading design underlying these architectures is rudimentary at best, or non-existent. My favorite project in this case are the server applications where you just start more of them. Samba would be an example. Apache is a great example. You know, if you know, if 8 cores, 16 threads, start 16 of them, great. Each has their own little thing, perfect. But a lot of software isn't written that way, so that's one thing we do. We, of course, do basic enabling for our chips, but we also do a lot more. We look at gaps in functionality that we think, if we were able to close them, will help us sell into a new market. For the last 3 months, Intel has been talking about these mobile internet devices. So think about the midpoint between a small laptop and an iPhone. It's x86 based and gives you the real internet. So not the no flash, no plugins version of the internet that you have on a phone today, but the real internet, small enough to take it with you. The software stack isn't quite ready for that. So we have an open source project trying to fix that. So it's very easy for us. But what does it mean to the projects? If any company goes into an open source project, you as part of the developers, you as part of the community of the project, need to take a very close look at why are they doing this? What are they trying to achieve? What are the strings that are attached? What are their interests? And be very careful when you invite them to join your project. The step from having contributions by a company to being taken over, co-opted, monopolized by a company is surprisingly small. And there are a number of usually somewhat smaller projects that have run into this issue, that there is a company that has so much control over the progress in the project that the developers are no longer free in what they're trying to do and they're no longer able to define their own future. Where there are people who say for Samba 4, maybe that would be the solution. When is it going to be released again? Never mind. At the end of some year, okay. But it actually gets much more difficult because the contributions that you get tend to be under a certain license. Hopefully it's one that is compatible with the one that you're using. Sometimes they're not, which creates all kinds of pain. But there is this wonderful parallel universe of patents. And some licenses do not protect you from contributions that may include patented code, which is why I guess Samba is using GPL, which makes that, especially in version 3, very clear that you're protected. A lot of the other licenses don't do that. So there are the licenses that no lawyer can explain to you, the famous artistic license, that clearly was written by a linguist and not by a lawyer. But no one really knows what it means, but we all are pretty sure that it certainly does not have a patent clause in it. So you can contribute code to that you hold a patent on and wait for this code to be, you know, distributed out into the world and then start suing people. That's not good. So be very careful where your code comes from. But that's kind of the evil side of contribution. The problems start much earlier. The problems start when a corporation has too much control over a project. And usually that happens if or in most cases where this happens today, the situation was kind of the other way around. So the company started the project. Or, you know, the three geeks who started the project then started a company. MySQL would be a typical example. MySQL, if you ask them, 98% of their code is written by MySQL employees. So according to the, you know, the Apache rule of three, that, you know, would not be an acceptable project. And the rule of three, I assume you all know that, says you have to have three diverse key contributors. Diverse meaning not working for the same company, not working in the same office at the same university, really different people from different backgrounds. And they need to be significant contributors. So not 98% and 1% and 1%, but the contribution needs to come from different people. And this diversity that Apache actually makes, it makes this one of the rules in order to be able to get out of the incubator to become a real ASF project. These rules have a lot going for them. Because if you have diverse contributors, it becomes much harder for a company to get into influence. It doesn't become impossible, but it becomes a lot harder. Look at Samba, for example. If you look where the key Samba contributors work, it's a very diverse environment. It's you know, companies with marginal interest in Samba. It's companies that very much have a business around Samba. It's companies that have an open source business. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of different interests, and different interests mean no one can easily co-opt this. So what do you do when someone knocks on your door? The easiest answer is, you know, don't answer. So do it alone. And that's, as I said earlier, that's what most open source projects do. Most of the small open source projects have no corporate overlord, no paid developers. Everyone does it in their spare time. Yet for most more serious projects, that is not an option. I mean, asking all these people here to quit their jobs and work for tips, like in the Dilbert cartoon, is not going to work. So as soon as you have critical mass, a certain amount of development going into these projects, you will have participation by people that have a commercial interest. So, and oh, by the way, that's a good thing, because as I said, I talk a lot to business people, and one of the questions I always get is, why do people do open source? Why would you give something away that you could sell? And I keep explaining one of these intangible benefits that they completely overlook is open source is a fantastic career path. Who in this room has his or her current job because they are an open source developer and were hired for that? I think there are at least 20 people who are lying. And I'm surprised how small the number is, actually. So most conferences I ask this question, it's half the room. Very surprised how few are here. It is a very viable career path. And that's a good thing, because we want, well, as a person who just raised his hand, I certainly want this ability to take the work as a developer, what you do as a hobby, and be able to make it into a job that, you know, pays decent salary. So you won't be able to cut the companies out. Not going to happen. So you have to live with them. How do you do that? You try to create what I call a level playing field. And there are great examples how not to do that. The JCP is I guess, the most famous one. Everyone familiar with the JCP? Java Community Process? It's a fantastic governance set of rules designed by Sun that basically guarantees that everyone can contribute to Java, but only Sun can make decisions. So there's this steering committee basically that has the final say on anything, and Sun has basically veto powers. So there was just a year ago a fantastic vote on a very important issue. Those votes are confidential, so no one can tell you how they ended. And the 12 non-Sun people in this vote all said they voted yes, and the committee voted no. So that is a process that is broken. That is a process that is not helpful to create a healthy open source project. So a level playing field is very important when you have corporate contributors, because you want these corporate contributors to be able to gain benefit, because that's why they do it. You don't want them to walk away after 6 months saying, "Ah, this isn't working for me." You want the contribution, you want the resources, the headcount, the money, whatever it is they want to give. But you don't want to get co-opted. You don't want to be in a situation where suddenly you as the open source developer, you as the community, plural, English does not distinguish between singular and plural, how bad most sane languages do. You don't want to be in the situation where suddenly the people who started all this no longer have control. And this level playing field is one that you will hear a lot of double talk about. You will hear a lot of corporations saying all the right words, having beautiful, colorful, well-done presentations. You notice that I don't have one, which is why I can bitch about them, that say all these wonderful words, how good and how benevolent they are, the Queen's English, benevolent they are. Yet their actions aren't aligned with what they say. Now on this one, I can't give a corporate example without getting into trouble, yet it is most likely pretty easy to figure out whom I mean. There is a company walking around saying, "Yeah, we are the biggest contributor open source, we are very active, we do all these great stuff." And you go down the list of projects that they give you, and everyone has this little flaw. For example, the license that allows them to create commercial products where they don't have to contribute back, but everyone else who uses it needs to contribute back. Or the decision process that is rigged that only they can make decisions. Or the project that is designed to be embedded into other projects, but that is only available under a GPL license, which means no one can use it in a commercial project, yet they can claim to be open source. So it is very easy to get into these management presentations, into these beautiful marketing presentations, and have someone say all the right words and have all the right examples and all the right numbers, yet the reality is completely different. And in a way that makes me very sad, because I think if you look at some of the developers who've given up, some of the developers who've walked away from open source, and there are quite a few by now, in a lot of these cases that was caused by spending a lot of effort on the project and then having it taken away from you, having the value of the project not realized, having lost the ability to control what you do, and that is not something where you want to run into. So understand the pitfalls. And sometimes that may mean that you have to say no to a contributor, and that's really hard. As I said earlier, I used to run X386, and we had a major corporation come to us, and they wanted to donate really interesting code that would have been extremely helpful to us. And this was, you know, something like 20 man years of work, very valuable contribution. But unfortunately, they said, "We can only contribute this under a certain license, a license that wasn't compatible with what we wanted. The X project is released under a BSD-style license, so basically the license that says you can do whatever you want as long as you don't claim that you wrote this." And we were certain that this was the right license, this was what we wanted. And after a lot of discussion in the core team, we decided to decline the contribution. And we said, "Sorry, you can send us your patches, but we will not take them. They will not become part of our project," which royally pissed them off. But often that is the right solution. You will have to say no to contributions that come with strings attached that you don't want. But very often there is a middle ground. Very often you can take these contributions and make them work for you. And there are a few very simple rules how to do that. I mean, first and foremost, you need to get the licenses out of the way. Licenses are terrible. Who of you has a law degree? Yay, I can make lawyer jokes. What's 10 lawyers at the bottom of the sea?
Good start.
Okay, no, never mind. Okay, right audience. I don't have a law degree either, which means when I'm confused about licenses, I talk to someone who does. And I really recommend that you do that. Really recommend that you do that. And what is so terrible about this is, A, many licenses are incredibly badly written. GPL V2 comes to mind, many others. And the interpretation of these licenses varies widely. If you talk to two of the rather well-known open source lawyers about the meaning of the GPL, you will get extremely different answers. So Larry Rosen of Rosen Law and Eben Moglen of the Software Freedom Law Center have widely different interpretations what the GPL might mean. So you need to find a lawyer that you trust who helps you figure out what the licenses mean and what strings could be attached and what taking contribution might mean. So for example, when Samba switched to GPL V3, which is a license that is maybe even less understood than GPL V2, that's quite a risk that you guys took there. And oh, by the way, it's a license that a lot of corporate users are deathly afraid of. So it's a license that in the future may create some problems for you. I am almost certain that at some point Samba will be forked over that license decision. And that's a pity. And I wish people had spent more time understanding the consequences of that step. And yes, that's exactly the same thing as taking a contribution on a different license, changing your own license. But let's assume we have the license part figured out. Let's assume you get a contribution. You get a significant contribution. What do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you try to not take that whole horse, that whole gift horse. Instead, you try to break it down into small pieces, and you try to assimilate these pieces in a way that starts getting you involved. What do I mean by this? Don't import 10 million lines of code into your project. Make people give you small patches, and make sure that current active contributors in the project start maintaining that new code. Linux is a wonderful example for that. Linux has this beautiful hierarchy of Linus, his key maintainers, his so-called lieutenants, it's like a dozen, 20 of them, depending how you count, and then their sub-maintainers. And then any code that is contributed needs to be contributed to a sub-maintainer. Oh, but all the different parts of the kernel have different sub-maintainers. So if we have a bigger project that we want to contribute, we have to talk to a dozen different sub-maintainers, which means this gets broken down into smaller pieces. And oh, by the way, these sub-maintainers are going to maintain the code, not you. Which means even though we contribute a lot of code, the code is not controlled, maintained by us, but is instead included in what is maintained by the current active trusted maintainers that are already there. That is a wonderful method to make sure that no one can suddenly change direction in a way that the community doesn't want. Still, very often, if you make bigger contributions, you can grow into a maintainer role yourself and you can gain the trust of people and be successful. So this is not locking out new contributors. But this is a way to avoid this silo mentality, where you say, oh, you know, there is this new block coming in and it's absolutely critical to the success of my project, but it's maintained by this company. Not a good plan. Hasn't worked very well. The MySQL is once again a great example. The way they designed what they did with the storage engines. They had this storage engine that was designed by a different project called InnoDB. Guess what? Oracle bought that company. That's a problem. If your main storage engine is suddenly controlled by the company who most likely wants to kill you. You don't want that. So be very careful how you handle these situations. If there is a component that you absolutely rely on, don't give that away. Don't allow somebody else to control this. And in open source, a lot is based on trust. Everything in open source is based on trust. Open source is not a software engineering phenomenon. Open source is a social phenomenon. I mean, of the people here that identify themselves as developers, I mean, many of you I've known for 10 and more years, and though none of you trust me, I certainly trust you, and that's how open source works. So if I send Jeremy a patch to the Samba code, he takes a good laugh and says, and goes on with life. Yet if he sends me a patch to Samba that fixes my problem, I'll most likely apply it and run the stuff because I know it'll work. So this trust thing is very important. So when companies contribute to projects, think about this in the context of trust. So the first question is, do you trust the company? Who trusts companies? That's very hard, because companies are kind of faceless, abstract entities. But almost always, these contributions come not just in the form of code, but they come in the form of people. And this is what is important. You need to learn to trust these people. You need to integrate these people into your community, into the way you do business. And you need to make sure that these people stay the same and these people don't disappear from you and that you maintain this relationship. Again, an example. When Intel contributes to open source projects, we have a lot of policies. We love policies. One of the policies is that we have to, before we have internal approval to do contributions, we have to identify a maintainer. An Intel employee who, from our point of view, is the maintainer of the project. That may not be the person who the bigger open source project considers the maintainer, but this is the person at Intel who has the job to make sure that this software, this code, is not abandoned. And one of the things this person has to do, and that's mandatory, is to become part of the community that continues to maintain that code. So you have to be on the mailing list, on the wiki, on whatever form of communication the IRC channel, the project uses. You have to look at Bugzilla. You have to be responsive to suggestions, to bug reports, to criticism, to architectural suggestions, etc. So this is something that we actively do. Other companies don't do that. But as you work with companies, that is something that you can suggest. So if a company comes to you and says, I have written this great piece of code, you know, that makes your computer levitate. Make sure that you say, hey, great, so who's the person who's going to work with us day to day, who's going to be on our mailing list, who's going to help us integrate this code? If they don't want to identify someone like that, I wouldn't take the code. Well, the levitating code I wouldn't take anyway, but actually, it's pretty easy, you know, just run a tight spin loop, get the processor to 100% load, and it just lifts off. It's beautiful. Or it burns through your desk. John mentioned earlier that his laptop is so incredibly hot. And I have a Mac, as is kind of obvious to say. And this is the second generation MacBook Pro. The first generation MacBook Pro, oh my God, this thing got hot. I mean, Apple removed any reference of the word laptop from the documentation and website because that thing got so hot that it was considered dangerous to have it on your legs. I mean, developers don't want children, I know, but still, don't do that. So, where was I going with that? Anyway, it's very important that you work with companies that are interested in your project. There is a lot of benefit to be gained. There is a lot of things you can do that you couldn't do without them. Because companies, if they're interested in something, they can throw amazing amount of resources and stuff. Again, I'm sorry I'm giving all these Intel examples. I don't want this to be an Intel marketing thing. But A, I know the details, and B, I cannot speak for other companies, so whenever I give examples of other companies, I get in trouble. So we released a virtualization architecture a couple of years ago. And we were kind of looking for software that would take advantage of that, because as I said earlier, don't have software, doesn't do you done good thing. So, sorry, that was slang. It is not an advantage for you to have that, I guess. So what do? We engage with the Zen project and we said, hey, I think you can use this wonderful hardware feature that we have to make virtualization go better. And the Zen guys said, great, yeah, we'll get a person on this sometime later this year. And we said, we were thinking of being able to release that, let's say, by August. And how about we put 30 engineers on that? And after a little bit of back and forth negotiations of how this would work, we put 30 engineers on that. Guess how large the core Zen development team was before we did that? 12. So adding 30 people to a 12 people project might create a very unhealthy imbalance. So we did a lot of work to ensure that there are checks and balances in place, that we have absolutely no way of controlling Zen. And oh, by the way, by now we have, I don't know, 5 people working on this, so this is all ancient history. But we worked with the Zen project in understanding what it would mean for us to have so many people working on this, and how we can make sure that their control of their own project doesn't change. How we create a way that check-ins go through a public review, and how we make sure that the architecture is discussed by everyone, and how we make sure that the control of the project doesn't shift. And as a project, this discussion is the important part. The pragmatism involved in this discussion is the important part. Corporations, with a few exceptions, are not evil. Yes, they have their own goals. Yes, they do this for very selfish reasons. But they can be wonderful help to projects, help that projects desperately need. And if I think about the Samba team, and we take away the developers who are sponsored by a corporation, Samba 4 will not happen at the end of some year. That is pretty clear. So if you go into this negotiation, if you talk to your corporate contributor, the most obvious question is, what's your leverage? I mean, besides saying, no, I don't take your code, what's your leverage? I think the by far biggest, or the thing that the corporations are most afraid of is the loud voice that projects have. Slashdot is a worst case example, but in so many ways. But there is a large audience that listens to the project, that listens to developers. There are a lot of journalists who are subscribed to your developer mailing lists. And all they do is they listen for interesting stuff to write about. What's interesting to write about? Conflict. So that's what sells stuff, right? War in Iraq sells newspapers. Doesn't do any else any good, but sells newspapers. So use this loud voice that you have, publicity, the fact that people listen, as your leverage in these conversations. So if someone comes to you and has some ideas and they don't want to budge, say, hey, what would you think if we discussed this in public? Wouldn't that be fun? You will soon see that most corporations really don't want to discuss stuff in public. Because during negotiations, you know, you might say something that you later regret, and some of your demands might be misunderstood by people as, you know, something close to extortion, and that doesn't look good in public. So Jeremy is totally cracking up in front. He seems to have first-hand experience with that. So what I'm trying to say is, no, don't threaten people that you're going to expose all the bad doings, but be well aware of the fact that they might want to control the message. And as part of granting them the ability to control the message, you very often can get concessions from them. You will very likely be able to get terms that are acceptable to you in return for working with them. And at the end of the day, that's what you want, isn't it? I mean, you want someone to contribute to your project. You want the help. But you want this at terms that you can live with. So keep this goal in mind, because one of the things that I've seen in a lot of open source projects is kind of this elitism, this holier-than-thou attitude. And as I say, I go out a lot and talk to people, and very often say, hey, we can help you with that. And you get this, we don't need you, you know, we're the open source community, we know better. And I don't think that's helpful. I think a pragmatic attitude is really helpful. If someone comes and says, you know, I have this several man years worth of work, this great project that I'm gonna give you, and here's what it'll do for you. Work with these people. They're gonna make your project better. They're gonna help you. Make sure it's on your terms, but work with these people. So at the end of the day, it's all about code, right? We all do open source software because we want software that sucks less. Which is, I think, the best quote of Eric Raymond ever. And we want to make sure that this happens in a way that we all are happy with the outcome, that no one drags us down a path that we don't want to go. A very specific example. I'll go back to the Linux kernel. A lot of companies are writing Linux drivers for the devices today because the market requires them. Some of the companies are writing these drivers as binary-only drivers. Some of the companies, mine for example, write open source drivers. The community is starting to put a lot of pressure out there saying, we don't want binary drivers. So this negotiation that I'm just describing, that I've talked about for the last 50 minutes, is happening right now, is happening today, between the Linux community and companies who want to contribute code. And the discussion is surprisingly early in its stage. There are a lot of companies who basically say, screw you, I don't care. I happily use your software to sell my hardware, but I won't abide by your rules. And then there are companies like, you know, Red Hat and Novell who say, that sucks. If I don't have the sources to your driver, I'm not gonna give my customers support. You deal with them. So there is this very nice give and take, and there is a lot of things the community can do to increase the pressure on companies to do the right thing. Because what we want is not only software that sucks less. We want software that we can reasonably debug. And oh, by the way, you can't debug binary modules. We want software that isn't controlled by anyone. We want software that no one can just take away from us. We want software that prevents lock-in. If someone really hates GPL v3, they can fork and take the old base and do a GPL version 2 version. If someone really hates, let's pick on Ubuntu, because I don't see a Ubuntu person in here, they can switch to Red Hat and it'll work just fine. Yeah, it's a little bit of migration effort. But there is no lock-in. That's what's great about open source. Open source is about solving problems. I think almost every open source developer started writing open source software because they tried to do something and it didn't work. Certainly is true for me. I see quite a few people nodding here. And to me, that is the main message of a talk titled The Role of Corporations in Open Source. The corporations can help you reach this goal to solve problems as long as you make sure that all these other little issues are addressed. And as John said at the end of his introduction, most of all, open source is about having fun. Thanks, guys.
Well, Dirk, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the conference here for your keynote message. You are a friend of this community, and I'd like you all to stand up and make a loud demonstration of your appreciation of Dirk's keynote today.
I love the way John is always looking out for your health and is making you get up every 30 minutes. It's just wonderful. Thank you.
Are you open to any questions, Dirk?
Certainly, yes. The gentleman back there, you look vaguely familiar.
Yeah, we have a mic for questions.
Yep. Some of the comments that you made about the developers and their loyalties towards the companies they work for seem to have an underlying assumption of that the individuals working for companies and the companies would have similar views. There's something that I've observed over the years that I think might change that a little bit, and that is that as developers spend more time working with a project, their loyalty tends to become more strongly to the project and less strongly to the company they work with, as they notice that companies come and go, but free software projects tend to live on. And so I think that changes a little bit the dynamics you were talking about with regard to the influence that companies have over and the caution you have to have with regard to dealing with corporate contributors. You have to instead look at the individuals and consider the individuals' motivations rather than trying to look up and look at the company. And instead just consider the company as, great, they're providing some money. We don't care why. We care about the motivations and the abilities and the contributions made by the individuals as individuals, not what their corporate affiliation is.
So I would have said I fully agree with you had you not done the last sentence and a half. So I said this earlier, yes, very much the concern is not about the true community members who happen to be paid. I mean, Jeremy, whether he gets paid by Sun or by, what was the other one, Novell, and then Google, it's completely irrelevant. Jeremy is Jeremy. Mm. But the concern is when a company comes in with code that is anonymous. That's why I said, as you get contributions, make sure you get the contributors. You build up these trust relationships. You break the code up into individual pieces so that you really have this community effect, that you don't have a company controlling a bit of code that is kind of separate from what you do, because that creates the negative situation that I'm afraid of.
Are you aware of the policy we have in the Samba team whereby contributions to the Samba project will only be accepted if they are personal copyright, not the corporate copyright?
I'm well aware of that, yes.
So that one, it tends to push things more towards the individual as opposed to the company.
Yeah, in theory, yes, it is very easy to work around this one. I have unfortunately been in negotiations where people were considering schemes to get around exactly this rule in order to do things that I considered improper. So it's a little more complicated than that. In the presentation, certainly, as you noticed, wasn't tailor-made for a Samba audience. The presentation is much more about open source as the methodology, as a sociological community effort, and what the corporate contributions do there. I don't think Samba is immune from the problem just because of the individual copyright clause. I think what is very important in Samba's case is the incredible breadth of the existing community. The fact that there are so many key contributors working in a very diverse set of companies really gives Samba a strength and a resilience.
I think we need more.
Well, yes, every project needs more. But I, if I compare this to other of the big, I mean, look at the you know, the big 10 open source projects, and you look at OpenOffice, and you look at MySQL, and you look at JBoss, and you will quickly see that their makeup of key contributors is very different. And that's where why I say Semba has more resilience there than other projects.
Mm. Okay.
We'll take one more question or comment if there is one from the audience.
Come on, Jeremy. It seems you have something on
Jeremy,
your
mind. Jeremy, yes. There you are.
Okay, that was a great question, Jeremy. Thank you very much. I always appreciate your question.
In case you guys didn't hear it, his question was, I think that was a great talk. I really liked it. And I appreciate the question. Thank you, Jeremy.
Dirk, thank you very much for your keynote.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to mixing with you over the course of the remainder of today.
I'll be here tomorrow as well.
And tomorrow, yes. Well, our next speaker is Andrew Tridgell. We all know Andrew. We all know that he gives a fairly compelling presentation too.